cursing away pain, paperless charting, patient care guidelines, and a review of insulin. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We're moving on into the second half of our summer here, and I just wanted to encourage everyone that's listening to continue to stay in touch and continue to spread the word about the show. I know that a lot of you have many things going on this summer, but keep in touch with the show via the newsletter or some other route so that when your time frees up as you finish up your summer activities, you'll be able to jump back in and catch up with The Nursing Show again right away in the fall. We have a lot of great stuff we're covering in this week's episode, but first I'd like to remind you that all of the information you find here in The Nursing Show, we include links to additional resources and follow-up articles because we can only provide so much general information here. It is your job as a listener to apply what you hear to your scope of practice and your particular set of guidelines, whether you're a student or a nursing professional for a long time. I try to cover and review things I think that everyone needs to look at from time to time, but it's your job to apply them to your own area of specific nursing practice. And you'll find those links over at nursingshow.com, and these give you the ability to really dig in more in depth beyond the 10 or 15 minutes that you might hear here on the show. You can also get in touch with me if you have any questions about anything we've covered, any of the news items or comments, or even corrections if there's been an error. We want to make sure that the community gets the correct information. You can send all of those comments in to comments@nursingshow.com. Don't forget, The Nursing Show is provided to you free of charge thanks to the generosity of our advertisers. So please take a moment and check out what they are telling you about. We try to provide information on products and services that you would be interested in here on the show. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a story that I picked up over at WebMD.com, and it is an interesting story on pain management. How many of you have banged your elbow or hurt yourself, or maybe, you know, I know I was out working in the yard this summer and banged my thumb pretty good with a hammer, and you know, what's the first thing that happens? Well, you start, you know, saying some of those things you probably shouldn't say in public, right? Well, apparently, those curse words, that swearing that happens when you hurt yourself or are in pain, actually can lessen the perception of the ongoing pain you're having. Now, we run into this in many different settings. Labor and delivery nurses run into it when women are in the middle of childbirth and sometimes take out their anger or pain at their husbands. I know I've experienced that in the past firsthand. We've also see it in many different settings, both in ourselves and in our patients, when they're experiencing a painful procedure or have had something happen to them that causes pain. Patients tend to curse and swear when they have pain, but is this just bad manners, or is there some physiological reaction to it? A recent study that was published in the journal Neuro Report, researchers at Keele University School of Psychology recruited 60 undergraduate students. These students actually had to put their hands in extremely cold, icy water and hold them there. And while they were doing this, one group swore, repeated a curse word over and over again, and another group repeated a neutral word over and over again. And what was found in the study, and of course this is a small survey group, but it's at least something that leads us into this direction, the group that repeated the curse word were able to withstand the cold and keep their hands in longer than the control group, and they were also able to report less pain when they went to report how much pain they actually felt. So these things seem to lead us to the fact that our brains tend to curse for a reason, and deal with the pain directly by distracting us from the pain when we have to endure something. It's interesting, and it just points out again that there are many different avenues for pain management. Now, I'm not going to encourage you to institute a swearing pain management program where you give your patients flashcards with certain flash swear words they can use during a painful procedure, but it may help you to understand that a patient who does swear during a painful procedure may in fact be doing that as a pain management tool physiologically built into them. I think it's something that's interesting and of course bears further study, but as nurses, we need to be open to all forms of pain management, and this just goes to show you that methods of distraction, no matter how they work, are certainly valid for managing patients' pain when other pain management methods aren't available or necessarily thought of in advance. So I like this study, and I would urge you to check out the article in the show notes. It certainly would be something to bring up in the break room or talk about over your next conference. Next up is a look at paperless charting. I'm sure a lot of us out there are dealing with moving to fully electronic reports, getting rid of those paper reporting, and doing more and more to allow nurses and other healthcare professionals to gather all of the reports in one place in an electronic format. And so looking at this particular article, it's an article out of looking at a study in Pittsburgh where a hospital there has moved entirely to a paperless format in their emergency department. They don't haul around x-rays. They don't look at printed out forms of x-ray film. They are looking at everything online. They are able to manipulate their studies and their visual studies a little bit better so they can look at different things, change the contrast. You know, how many times have you been in a situation where in the past the doctor has said, you know, this film is overexposed. I can hardly see what I need to see. I need to change the exposure because we're looking for something different. Now with the new electronic x-ray reporting, when you have a JPEG of an x-ray, you can change the color contrast and change different things to look for things like a pleural effusion in a chest x-ray versus looking for rib fractures. You know, there's different ways to manipulate that material. And the same thing goes for also text-based reporting and makes it a little bit easier. If you're saying and doing the same things over and over again, it's a little easier to report if you just have a checkbox for checking for pain. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't be writing good nursing notes, and those should still continue, but it may mean that we can change the focus of our nursing notes because some of the things that we might report can be reported in a paperless form through a checkbox system or drop-down menus or things like that. And I would urge you to embrace those things because, you know what, they're not going to go away. We're going to see more and more of this as a way of saving time, storage space, and really streamlining the medical records process. And that's something that's coming down from the federal level as we move towards some kind of a system of electronic patient record keeping. So, you know, when you have a patient that's on a vacation in your region visiting family members, they come into the ER, they get admitted to the hospital, wouldn't it be great to contact their physician or their previous hospital stay and get a copy of records electronically transmitted so that you can have a full background on this patient very quickly and efficiently? There's definitely some privacy concerns built into this, but this is something that ultimately can really improve the way we care for our patients. Finally, a look at nursing care guidelines for certain types of patients. It's important for there to be a standard of care and for there to be evidence-based medicine and research involved, and that includes good, high-quality nursing research. And as our specialty organizations, our specialty branches of nursing move into publishing more and more high-quality nursing research and looking at interventions that work versus interventions that don't work, it's going to be important for every one of us, especially those in generalized care settings such as med-surg, emergency departments, and physicians' care offices. We're going to be very much relying on these patient care guidelines released by the specialty nursing associations. So I just point that out because an article cropped up in my news search over at medicalnewstoday.com from the Society for Vascular Nursing. This is a group of nurses dealing with patients with vascular disease and dealing with patients that have a variety of needs for specific vascular care. And the Society for Vascular Nursing has released a series of guidelines that are being developed to look at patients with vascular disease, to develop a standard of care. So perhaps you're in a small rural hospital that doesn't have a dedicated vascular nurse or nursing specialist. You can look up these guidelines and apply at least some of the principles and things they've put in place as vascular nurses in other parts of the country, and you can apply those specifically to your patient in that smaller setting. And I'm looking forward to more organizations putting out information like this for those nurses that are working in generalist settings so that they can provide more focused and specialized care in places where they may not have access to a specialized nursing staff system. So read this article and keep your eyes open for other specialized patient care guidelines, because I think this is something that you can develop a resource list for in your community. And when you have that patient that has special needs, you can go to that resource or contact a nurse in that specialty, perhaps via their specialized organization, and you can get some information on how to best care for your patient. Time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week we're going to be looking at the different types of insulin, something that I think we need to review from time to time. I know the nursing students out there need to review this, especially as they go through their programs and need to be prepared to answer questions, both in the classroom and the clinical setting, about insulin. And so it's something that we all should keep in mind, whether we're in a home care setting dealing with a diabetic patient or in a facility. It's important to understand the different types of insulin that our patients have prescribed and exactly how they work so that we can help these patients dial in to their diabetes care plan. This is something that we can have a huge impact with later on in their lives, as the better they adhere to their care plan early, the better their profile is as they progress through the disease as they grow older. And this is something that we need to keep in mind. You know, we're promoting best practices when we're promoting the overall better health care for our patient when we help them understand better. And of course, that means we have to understand better. I have a bunch of resources in the show notes, so I want you to check out nursingshow.com, and in the nursing podcast category, you'll find this episode's show notes. And there's some resources there from a couple of different sources, including the American Diabetes Association, also something from a pharmaceutical company that produces insulin and diabetes products. There's a great section on Diabetes Learning Center there that will provide good resources for your patients as well. So I urge you to follow up on these particular resources that I have found. Insulin is divided up into several different classes based on the time of onset and peak and duration of the medication's life in the body. And so you have basically four different types: rapid acting, short acting, intermediate acting, and long acting forms of insulin. You also have several different types of premixed insulins, and these are usually combinations of a rapid acting and an intermediate or long acting form of insulin, so that they get that immediate burst of insulin into their system, and then they have a slow release of insulin over time into their system from the secondary form, either an intermediate or a long-acting form of insulin. And some patients tolerate different types of insulin better. And as patients grow older, their reaction to certain types of insulin may be different, and they may have to change how they administer their insulin as their body's metabolism changes, as their bodies grow older and things just tend to slow down. So we need to make sure that we are following up with our patients each time we see them, because they may need to have adjustments, and we're going to likely be the first people to notice that, and we can pass that information along so they get a change in their insulin prescriptions. So let's start off with our rapid acting insulin. Rapid acting insulins usually have an onset within 15 minutes. They have a peak time of their action of 30 to 90 minutes, and they last 3 to 5 hours in the system. And these are medications like Novolog and Humalog. So you might see those there, and I would urge you to remember log there. Novolog and Humalog, that log means rapid acting. So I don't know how you'd aspire that to a particular type, but just remember log is going to be coordinated with rapid acting. Next up, you have short-acting insulins, and this is Humulin and Novolin R, and this is your regular insulin, generally known as your regular insulins, and your onset is 30 to 60 minutes, and peak time is 2 to 4 hours, with a duration of 5 to 8 hours on board. So this is something that you'll see, and you want to make sure, usually R for regular. Short-acting is your regular insulin. Intermediate acting insulins include Humulin N, Novolin N, and that N is going to be correlating with a longer term of action, intermediate acting insulin. Onset is generally 1 to 3 hours, and your peak time will hit at about 8 hours with a duration of 12 to 16 hours. This, again, is your intermediate acting insulin. Then you have your long acting insulin. The one I've seen most commonly is Lantus, although there is another brand name, Levemir, and these particular long-acting insulins have an onset of about 1 hour. They are considered peakless, so they slowly release with no peak action, but they last in the system from 20 to 26 hours, so about a day on long-acting insulin. It's like a once-a-day shot. And for patients that are pretty good at maintaining their diet, that are pretty steady and regular in their blood sugar counts, this is probably what you'd like to get them to, once-a-day insulin, rather than having to administer insulin with every meal, or patients that are not appropriate for an insulin pump. You have your basic premixes that will have a combination, again, of rapid acting and long acting or intermediate acting. And again, because of the rapid acting, they're going to have that 15-minute onset, and their duration will be about 10 to 16 hours and maybe a little bit longer. So you see that the combination works well for some people. And you'll see these often in a premixed insulin pens that many of us are using in the hospital setting to administer meds to our patient. It's easier to measure. We don't have to mix insulins like we used to, and premixed syringes make it very easy to have one insulin pen per patient and administer them until the dose is gone, and then we go ahead and have pharmacy send up another pen. So again, you have your rapid acting, which has an onset of 15 minutes, peak time of 30 to 90 minutes, duration of 3 to 5 hours. You have your short-acting insulins or your regular insulin, 30 to 60-minute onset, 2 to 4-hour peaks, and 5 to 8-hour duration. Your intermediate-acting insulin has a 1 to 3-hour onset with a peak time of 8 hours and a duration of 12 to 16 hours. And then your long-acting insulin's going to last about the whole day, 20 to 26 hours, according to the information I've found. Onset in about 1 hour after administration, and it is considered peakless. So it is a long, steady release of insulin into the system. Again, there are tons of information out there. I've provided you links to information more for you as medical professionals, as well as a group of information you might find useful for your patients when they are asking you questions about it. You can provide them some additional online resources to explain types of insulin to them. And some of the best information you'll find is over at the American Diabetes Association, as well as that pharmacy site, the pharmacology site. You know, we get on our drug companies a little bit, but they do have the resources to provide some excellent learning information and resources on their sites. And the Diabetes Learning Center I've linked to is one of them. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody again for listening in and remind you to spread the word about The Nursing Show. The best way to help out the show is to spread the word and let other folks know about it. And if you're on the newsletter for The Nursing Show, you can just forward that email right on to somebody else. They'll get links to the current episode, listen in right there off their email, and also all of the follow-up links. So it's a great way for you to spread the word that way. Of course, visit us over at nursingshow.com. We've had lots of articles posted in recent weeks, and I would urge you to check out those articles and leave comments on them. It's always great to hear back from you, and you don't have to agree with me. Leave a comment and disagree. I have no problem with that. I don't tend to edit comments at all unless there's inappropriate language or something in there, but usually it's great just to hear another person's point of view. So definitely get on the website, nursingshow.com, and comment back on the articles and information you find over there. Don't forget to check back in with me with the email comments@nursingshow.com if you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or other information you'd like to leave. I'll close out the show, as I always do, with some PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This week, a song from an artist by the name of Cofield Mundy. She's a new artist I picked up over there, and I hope you like her songs. You'll find this song called Leave the Bones listed over at my site, and you can also follow the link there to iTunes if you'd like to purchase it for yourself. But I want to thank Cofield for making her music available, and you can always let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show if you like what you hear. So that's it for me. I want to remind all of you to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Walk right in, don't give a damn. Take what you need and just leave the bones. If I could tell you what makes the heart break, what makes the soul shake, well, I would be a rich girl. If I could tell you